Hello everybody, this is Stefan Sasse, contributor to the Tower of the Hand homepage and writer of the Dance with Dragons reread, and we are here in the newest edition of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, which has the catchy acronym BLAH, and with me today is...
I'm Sean T. Collins. I am the blogger behind BoiledLeather.com, also known as All Leather Must Be Boiled, which is where the Boiled Leather Audio Hour is hosted. And I am the co-author of the annotated A Game of Thrones for the iPad app Subtext with Anne Grohl and Elio Garcia. And joining us once again, I am very happy to say, is a special guest.
Hi, everyone. This is Amin from the podcast of Ice and Fire, and I'm here one last time to talk about board games and other games.
So, as Amin already mentioned, we are today talking about games of Ice and Fire, and we picked three especially to talk about, which will be the board game, which is called A Game of Thrones, The Board Game, a very catchy title. It is produced by Fantasy Flight Games and is now republished in a second edition. We will also be talking about Battles of Westeros, a tactical game that's sort of a crossover between tabletop and normal board games, also published by Fantasy Flight Games. And we will talk at last of Game of Thrones Genesis, the recently published video game in the world of Ice and Fire, published by Cyanide Video Games, a French company not recently known to many people. So, let's start with the Game of Thrones board game by Fantasy Flight Games. Just to give a quick introduction, if you ever played Diplomacy, the board game, the 1970s classic, you will be familiar with the concept. You play as one of the factions, and you are trying to conquer several spots on the board, and you have to do a whole lot of negotiating with other players and to deceive them, basically get your forces in the right position. There is a lot to the overall strategy and diplomacy part, and not so much into the actual fighting. That part is pretty short and very easily handled. So let's give the ball back to Amin. What did you think when you first played and later played Game of Thrones, the board game?
Well, I played the first edition when it came out in 2003. So I've been playing it for a while. And what happened, they had the five main factions: House Stark, House Tyrell, House Greyjoy, House Baratheon, and House Lannister. And then they added, with an expansion pack, House Martell. And what they've done recently now, just this year, is given out a second edition, which basically just combines those two things. So instead of having to buy the original game and the expansion pack, you can just buy the six house faction. And I found that it really matches the theme of the books. There's a lot of negotiation, diplomacy, but only one person can be on the throne in the end. And so there's a lot of backstabbing going on. That's how I'd characterize the game.
Yeah, definitely. There's a big backstabbing part involved, because you have to, each round, you have to issue orders to your troops. You put them down, face down on the board. You have a certain number of orders you can issue. And normally you are partially cooperating and trying to coordinate these orders with your neighbors, if you don't wage war against them, of course. But whether you are waging war against them or not is only obvious to everyone once the orders are revealed, and then there is no turning back. So it could be that you are just deceiving your Lannister friend in the south while you are really wanting to attack him and to try to trick him into not being prepared or something, which can lead to the obvious "what the hell are you doing" moment in the game when you destroy the carefully crafted plans of someone. So, do you have any questions up to that part, Sean, because you are sitting in more or less for the audience that has never played the game?
Yes, I am everyone. If you have not played these games, I am your proxy for this conversation. And yeah, my main question, because I'd heard about this game before. There's a review that, with any luck, I'll be able to dig up from the recesses of my browser history and post a link to when this episode goes up. But I remember reading a review where the reviewer was like, prepare to lose friends if you play this game with friends of yours, because it's obviously, as you guys say, it hinges on being willing to stab people in the back, people with whom you've made alliances, you know, if it serves your purpose later down the line. So my main question is, I'm just curious, could you be honorable the whole time? Like, if you wanted to, would you have a shot at winning the game if you were the Eddard Stark of this board game?
In my opinion, yes. You could win with being honorably if you are willing to get little compromises on what exactly is noble and honorable. Because you will not win without waging any war. Yeah. But I think you could play it with open cards. For example, saying that this turn I will have to attack Seaguard because it's just necessary. So we could fight over it or we could not, but here it is what I will do. I have actually seen people play like this, and sometimes I play like this myself. And it is a way to play the game, but you will have an easier time if you betray people. Of course, they might take revenge on you.
I would say that you can play, maybe not quite like Eddard Stark, but you can play honorably in the sense that, let's say you play with a group that plays more than once. I generally hold to my agreements. I just don't make long-term agreements. I'll give somebody a one or two turn truce because you need to have some diplomacy in this game. You can't just win by yourself. But I will not make a long-term alliance. So if I'm not giving you a deal, maybe you should pay attention to me that turn. So, and another thing that Stefan mentioned, there's a lot of conflict in this game, but there's also a lot of bluffing. Sometimes, like, you will say, I'm taking this, and that's, like, you might as well just give it to me. That sort of thing, intimidation. And third party, because there's attacking and there's defense in this game, but there's something called support, where a third party can support in a battle, and that can be really crucial in determining who wins in a certain area.
Yeah, oftentimes that really is important. Or you can take away support from someone else. There are a lot of orders that interfere with the orders of others without directly engaging at them. So you don't have to wage war in order to harm someone or help someone, which is always kind of a step people are willing to ignore, which is an interesting thing, because if someone attacks you, you are normally mad and you want to take revenge and stuff. But if someone just supports an aggressor, you are normally not mad with him. I don't know why this is, but it is a phenomenon I have witnessed in other games like this too.
And another thing, like, people, when they first start playing, they focus on attack and defense kind of commands, but the other commands are really important, and you will learn how important they are. You know, commands where you can build up your money, commands where you can raid, you can get rid of other commands. You will eventually learn how those are actually perhaps even more important. A wall plus raid can be more important than a normal attack, depending on the situation. So.
Yeah, there is a mechanism in the game, which is, I believe, called a Game of Thrones. I have the German edition of the board game, so I'm not exactly sure about the terms in the international version. But you have to bid influence there.
Yeah.
The game comes with little markers that stand in for influence, and you gain them with about several methods. But basically, at certain points in the game, you have to bid influence in three areas. There is the political area, the Iron Throne area, where you where you determine the order in which the orders are taken out, and that determines who will win in the case of a tie, which happens oftentimes. Then there is a battle area. The better you are there, the more advantages you get in battle. And at last, there is something they call the Raven, where that helps you managing orders and stuff. And you have to decide not only in which area you want to be strong, because it is impossible to be strong in every area. You have to bid influence after all. But you have also to anticipate what resources your enemies have and where they will put their influence mostly. So if you know that Baratheon is going for the Iron Throne, for example, you may just bid enough to get on second place and save your influence for being the best in the battle area. And decisions like that very much predominate.
Who starts on the Iron Throne then? Is there a force that you need to depose, or is it just that open season?
No, there are starting positions. The Iron Throne track is inherited by the Baratheons at the beginning of the game. The best battle-wise are the Greyjoys, and the best with the Raven are the Lannisters. And the Tyrells, they are advantage in every position. They are not good in any, they are not bad in any. And the Starks are pretty good in battle, and the Raven, I believe, and very bad on the Iron Throne track. It more or less reflects the situation in the books. And when Amin said the thing with you basically are honest with your agreements, this is especially important if you play with the same group over and over again, because people tend to remember how you behave in games like this. And much of the diplomacy in a game like a Game of Thrones, the board game, is conducted over several games, not really consciously. It's more in the subconscious of every player. Who can I trust? And to earn that trust is difficult difficult, and when you lose it once, you basically lose it for several games, which can really hurt you. And that is an interesting thing, and I think your reviewer meant this when he talked about losing friends.
Yeah, I did find the review, by the way, just now. It's at shutupshow.com, and the way the person puts it, it's two people reviewing it, and the guy who lost it, Paul, says, "I console myself with the terrible truth that success in a Game of Thrones means being a very, very bad person. Someone with no moral fiber that maidens flee from and dogs turn their noses up at, just like in the books, then." So it sounds like it can be quite cutthroat, but you guys still have a good time playing it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think if you don't mind, I'd like to just mention a couple constructive criticisms of the game, like problems with it and the solutions that are there. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
One thing, I mean, this is not really a problem per se, but it takes a freaking long time to play the game because people do negotiate, and especially if you allow people to go outside of the room and have talks outside, that takes a while, right?
Yeah, that increases the time manifold.
But one solution is having a timer. Like you have a timer for every turn, and what that does, it forces you to play faster and to negotiate faster, but you also get good at, there's a lot of downtime sometimes. Two people might be fighting or something and choosing their leaders, that sort of thing. You can already start planning for your next turn and use that time to your advantage, and then once you do that, the game becomes manageable time length.
Couldn't you just shout at people, "Hey, winter is coming"?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. We also had the problem with rounds that took too long, and we introduced a timer too, and that makes it really much more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Another really cool thing we do is we do written notes between people, and so you can write messages, but you can also kind of do psychological stuff where you write messages, but it's just a joke or something, and then we look at them at the end of the game. So it's kind of interesting.
Oh. Now, let me ask you guys, when you play, do you, I'm sure this is just a matter of personal preference, but when you select the house that you're playing, does that selection influence your behavior at all? Like, are you, aside from what you said, how Greyjoys have an advantage in battle and things of that nature, does it affect your decision-making process? Like, well, I'm a Lannister, so you can, I don't mind pulling off the equivalent of the Red Wedding, or, oh, I'm a Stark, so I need to be more honorable in my dealings with my allies, or things like that.
To be honest, no, not exactly. It's a board game, after all, and not a role-playing game. But the structure of the game, like the rules are, like the map is shaped, like several things play together, forces you for different behavior for every of the factions. The Greyjoys, for example, obviously need ships. If they ever lose the dominance over the seas, they are lost. And the Starks, they are pretty isolated. They can be more or less neutral in most of the conflicts without getting involved if they don't want to and stuff like that. But you normally don't play a certain playstyle for ambience reasons alone.
I would pretty much agree with Stefan on that. Each house does have its own opening strategies because of their placement on the board. But with one exception, it seems in every iteration, the designers hate Lannister and they like Greyjoy. That's the way they start up. Although, in reality, in the books, Lannisters were in a precarious position as well, right?
True.
So they do that. And so when you play as Lannister, you must play diplomatically and you must try to get allies and do that sort of thing. If you just try to play by yourself as Lannister, you're going to have trouble compared to Stark or some other faction that can kind of turtle away from the main conflict.
Okay.
The game is generally not that well balanced. There are factions that clearly are stronger than others, but since it has such a heavy focus on diplomacy, you can usually weigh in on behalf of weaker factions, and you have to, because else someone is marching to victory. And it becomes a problem if you have a player on the table that is not really engaged in the game and refuses to take part in diplomatic stuff, then the whole game breaks. I witnessed that. So you have to play it with people that are willing to play such a game and commit to it, or else it won't be fun.
Yeah, and if you're playing with your wife and your girlfriend, you have to be able to fight them if need be.
No, yeah. Like,
in all seriousness, that was something I was going to bring up, thinking about the prospect of myself ever playing this game. I feel like I would have to steel myself for being a bastard to people, you know? I'm just such a nice guy, of course, that it would be difficult. I'd have to prepare myself for, like, all right, I'm stabbing people in the back left and right. Let's do this. It would take some psychological conditioning, I think.
Yeah, but it is the same thing to ignore friendships. You simply have, in games like this, you have to be able to see that there are rivals, there are enemies, and we are all competing in a game. You can't, if you play a game of football, for example, and your wife is in the other team, you can't just let her score. That would destroy the whole game. And it is the same with board games. You have to play by the rules, and the rules are you try to win and not to try to be a nice girl like in your relationship.
You need to play to win. If someone just gives up, that can pretty much end the game.
And, yeah, it blows it.
Yeah, and when you have a group of people playing to win, interesting things happen. It's like there's certain games I fought with a guy 5 turns in a row, and we end up working together because we both want to win, and somebody else rose too early, got too powerful too early. You don't want to do that.
No, never. Always be in second place. Second place is great.
Yeah. I have one final constructive criticism of the game. Now, yeah, as Stefan pointed out, the starting houses are not balanced, you know, equally, but diplomacy can make up for that, so that's okay. Like, as long as people realize which houses are stronger and you keep an eye to it. But what kind of annoyed me is because the Lannister Greyjoy scenario, they're both very close to each other. That area of the map is kind of fundamentally just flawed the way it is. And in the second edition, they didn't really help the situation. They made it worse. Like, because beforehand they had given Lannister all these nice cards in the expansion pack to, they were specifically there to beef up Lannister to deal with Greyjoy. And then the second edition, it's like even worse for Lannister in some ways. So that's if I was going to rate the second edition, I'd give it 4 out of 5 lemon cakes, and the previous version 4.5. I'd actually give it a little bit lower. But that being said, it's still a great game. I really enjoy it, and it's worth buying. And this, one of the solutions to this problem is to go online to Board Game Geek, where they have all these different discussions. And if you look there, people have come up with strategies for Lannister play and other factions to play. And if you look at those, then it'll help you playing the game, and variants as well.
Yeah, definitely. I also have nitpicks with the game. It is a very good game, mechanics-wise. There is not much to criticize in the mechanics, how the orders work, how the areas work together, and all that stuff. That is really well done. My problem is with the theme. I don't feel particularly Song of Ice and Fire-y when I play the game, because there are several things that are ordered by the mechanics, so to speak, that are not really fitting with the background. For example, Seaguard is a natural area of influence for Greyjoy. They Greyjoys are always holding Seaguard in the game, and the Lannisters are always conquering Riverrun. Riverrun is Lannister territory in this game, and I always feel that's not right. That's so not right. And Harrenhal is always conquered by either Lannisters or Baratheon, and stuff like that. And Old Nan is a battle commander you can use. are things.
And Patchface too. Patchface and Old Nan.
And such things throw me off, because it feels like they are just throwing out the names with the license they bought without giving it too much thinking about how it fits in the game. But in other aspects, they do, because Eddard Stark, for example, compared to Tywin Lannister, their special abilities really fit the character. But others, they simply don't fit in at all. And that throws me off balance several times when I play the game. So I'm trying not to think of it too much as Westeros when I'm playing it, because then I would always think this. It's not exactly the Westeros I know. The dominance of the navy is another thing. You can't win the game without ships. It doesn't matter which faction you play. You have to have ships and dominate the seas. The Starks have to have one of the biggest fleet on the table and fight the Baratheon fleet. They have no other chance, and that is not exactly the Song of Ice and Fire as we know it. But if you are able to overlook such things, you can very much enjoy the very good mechanics of the game.
I have to say, there's something more than slightly terrifying about Patchface as a battle commander. that may be something Martin may want to consider for the remaining books. That would be a direction that he could go in that I think the fans would really get behind.
Yeah, surely.
Salandra sees a circle of skulls around him, right? Something like
exactly
that.
Exactly right. And, you know, hey, if he's going to beef up Osha's part and maybe add Roz into the books because of the show, he can certainly make General Patchface because of the game.
I don't know if I'd like Roz being put in the book. I'll say one idea, like, Elio summed up Roz pretty well. She's kind of like a amalgamation of the various, like, prostitute characters, so it's easier to show as one character. So I don't know if I'd like to see a Roz in the book, but that's just my opinion.
No. Well, what about Roz as a battle commander in the game for a third edition?
Yeah, well, you could. I certainly see her there if I take into account what they used up until now.
Well, they had Cersei as a battle commander, so.
Well, okay.
Yes.
Well, you know, Roz sleeps with nearly every power player in the entire Seven Kingdoms, so she just murders them after she's done. She really is one of the best battle commanders in Westeros.
Yeah.
She'll have a special text ability or something.
Right. Right.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. Okay, are there any questions left, Sean?
No. It sounds really interesting.
I have one last comment again, just because there's a solution for this. Again, the game lists 3 to 6 players, right?
Yeah.
But it's best with 6.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially in the second edition. And now, again, that's another thing. They kind of made it a little worse for 5 and 4 players than it was before. But if you go online, the people have come up with variants that you can play. And so if you follow those, then you can play it with less people and it's still good. So
yeah, I had the same experience. If you take away players from the recommended 5 or 6, depending on which edition of the game you own, you just get gross imbalances. For example, with 4 players, there are no Greyjoys, so the Lannisters can easily conquer the Iron Islands and hold them for the whole game, and they are a powerhouse and stuff like that. That's a problem, but you never can do games like this balanced for players fewer than Originate. So
that makes sense. Yeah, I can see how a gap like that would so easily be filled by one of the remaining houses that it would give them sort of an unfair advantage. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, if you take a house out, all its neighbors will gain stuff because not only is the rival gone, but they also can take his areas, and the other guys, they don't win anything. So without Greyjoys, the Lannisters are becoming too powerful.
Yeah.
But it's
What's next on our menu of games today, gentlemen?
The next game on our menu would be Battles of Westeros. It came out in 2010, I believe. It's fairly recent. And it was also produced by Fantasy Flight Games. It has a little history to it, because Fantasy Flight Games took over the license to a similar board game, also in a fantasy world, which was called Battle Lore. And you have 2 players putting their fantasy armies against each other with a fairly simple system, and trying to use their tactical abilities to gain a foothold against the enemy, an advantage against the enemy, and to reach certain goals predicted by the scenario. And they made a new game out of it when they had problems with their original license and made it into a Westeros-shaped game. And the base game gives you the forces of the Lannisters and Starks, and several scenarios of the beginning of the conflict of the War of the Five Kings, and they are constantly expanding the game with new units. And you have a board with hexagon shaped tiles on which you move your troops, which are modeled in plastic, very detailed plastic models, and beautiful to look upon. And you command them with cards that you draw, so there is a certain element of luck in it. And then you try to get into favorable positions and hope that your troops prove to be better than the enemies, and to reach certain goals like conquering a bridge or killing an enemy commander, stuff like that.
So what are some of the battles that you get to play out?
I have to admit I don't have any in my mind ready. There, I remember a scenario for beginners in which you fight a Stark force commanded by Rickard Karstark that tries to hold 2 points that are accessible only over forts and bridges. And the Lannisters have to take these points away from the Starks. And they have cavalry, while the Starks have nearly none. And cavalry is very strong in the game, obviously, because knights simply trample down anything. But the game is very difficult for the Lannister player, because Rickard Karstark is so powerful. He defeats everyone, basically. And so that's one of the scenarios. There is one in which you can burn a camp, if I remember correctly, like burning the camps at the Siege of Riverrun. There are certain alternative scenarios how battles could have been in the books if the events had changed in some way, so they can include Eddard Stark, for example, as a battle commander on the Stark side, if he had escaped somehow, I don't know. Stuff like that is implemented. And there is also a skirmish mode in which you can have equal forces that just battle away without any background.
So, would you recommend the game and specifically to, for example, the board game? Even people who aren't usually board game people could play that. But for this, would you recommend this to the average person or to a gamer or what?
This is a very much more difficult question than it was with Game of Thrones, a board game, because Battles of Westeros is fairly expensive. I think the base is about $100 or something, and it is worth the money because of the beautiful sculptures, but still, it is a lot of money. You can only play it with two players, and it has this element of tabletop gaming in it, which means you have to have a fable for it. You have to have fun when you think about where to position your archers, whether to move three or four spaces, stuff like that, measuring range of bowmen, all these things. They don't really apply to as much gamers as do for a Game of Thrones board game, because it is more special, more oriented toward a certain group of players. So if you think tactical battles are a thing you like, then it is good. But if you are more the casual gamer, then I think it will be too special in the way it is made up. It will be overwhelming. You know what I mean?
Yeah. In my case, my house is small enough that I think just the need for a tabletop might be prohibitive. I
Yeah.
don't know that I don't think I have one to spare.
No,
But
the game is not very big.
oh
I
no.
think a Game of Thrones, the board game, needs a larger table than Battles of Westeros does. It is just the feel of a tabletop that it combines. It is a bastard between normal board games and tabletops. Fantasy Flight Games does a lot of these. It tries to take the best of both worlds, the easy accessibility of a board game and the rather small space it occupies, but the mechanics of a tabletop. And you have to go for that kind of thing.
Here's a question. Looking at the website for the game, obviously, as you described, you start out Stark versus Lannister. It's for two players, and there's all these different little sort of expansion packs or whatever the term is, where you can pick up the Brotherhood Without Banners, and you get various, extra Northern commanders, extra Stark commanders, and so on. Now, do you feel that this is reflective of the Game of Thrones experience, the Song of Ice and Fire experience that you get from the books? Do you think it are the conflicts and characters involved, and characters probably not the best word since it's obviously not a role-playing game, but is it accurate to the books in a way that the board game can sometimes not be?
I feel it is a bit of an unfair comparison because the Battles of Westeros game takes such a small part of this whole Song of Ice and Fire cosmos. It concentrates on tactical battles alone. They are not even big battles like you do in a Game of Thrones board game. You don't have to think about diplomacy. You don't have to think about any stuff other than to outposition, outflank, and finally defeat an enemy force. So you ha don't have so many areas where you can miss transporting the Song of Ice and Fire feel, you know? Whereas in the board game, you have to bid for influence, you have to muster troops, you have to fight the wildlings, build fleets, build catapults, and stuff and stuff and stuff. In the Battles of Westeros game, you have to fight battles, and that's basically it. And you have these leaders, and they are certainly, in most cases, very good representations of the battle skills, so to speak, of the book characters. For example, Robb Stark has Greywind at his side and can use him to his advantage. Rickard Karstark is just a mean son of a bitch that can take a whole lot of punishment. Tywin Lannister has certain abilities commanding the reserves, stuff like that. So they capture that very well. But obviously, the Song of Ice and Fire is about much more than battles. So it is hard to judge in a way. You can only take this very little scene of it.
That's something else that I wanted to get at for all three games. And I guess the best comparison that I can make here in terms of setting up this question is I've always been sort of disappointed with the comic adaptations of A Song of Ice and Fire and that world, because the art style tends to be done in your basic superhero influenced heroic North American mainstream comic book industry style, which is fine. I mean, obviously, I read plenty of superhero comics and other comics in that vein, but it just seems odd because so much of the appeal of prose series, and then also with the television series, which I found very successful is the revisionist element, that it doesn't feel like just the umpty-umpth, you know, knockoff Tolkien. You know, there's so much more going on in terms of it, thematically, the way it's written, obviously the frankness with the language and sex and violence and all the other things that people talk about and all the things that we've talked about at great length, Stefan, about war and morality and things of that nature. So for me as a comics critic, because that's sort of my background, I'm always disappointed that none of this really comes through. I mean, obviously you can't get rid of all of it because you're adapting the original, you know, so it's there in the text, but the art still feels like any old sword and sorcery, you know, sword and sorcery fantasy story. And that's just not what the story is. So I'm always left a little cold. And so I'm curious with any of these games, they're limited in what they can deal with because it is a game. You have to have, there has to be a competition element. And obviously that makes the most sense then to structure it around war and battles and things like that. But do you feel like you're, in that sense, the sort of that appeal that A Song of Ice and Fire has that other fantasy books maybe don't? Does that come through in these games?
I mean, do you want to start or?
Did you play the second expansion for the board game, The Storm of Swords, Stefan?
No, not yet. I have it bought, okay. But I never played it.
Yeah, because I would say of the board games, that maybe comes the closest to what you're saying, because in that one, for example, you're going for claim over Westeros, and there's different ways you can get it. You can get it politically, you can get it via bidding, and things like that. So I feel of the board game, that's probably the closest to what you're looking for.
I see.
And second, maybe I guess we're going into the card game. Maybe from what I've heard, the card game is also close to the books. So I don't know.
Okay.
What would you say on that?
Yeah, I can't really comment on the card games either because I only played them once at a convention and sneaked into it. But in the board games, these issues are a problem. In a Game of Thrones board game, you have very stylized tokens and pieces. They are only symbolic. You have a man, basically, for infantry, a horse head for cavalry, and a strange-shaped piece for catapults, and a ship-shaped piece for ships, and that's basically it. So you have to fill it with your own imagination, which works just fine, because the map you put around these pieces is still Westeros. You can't make anything wrong there. In Battles of Westeros, it becomes much more of an issue, because these sculptures are so detailed, so rich in details, that you almost certainly will stumble over one of them and think, oh no, that's not what I envisioned. I had the problem with several of those, because some you think, oh man, they look so good, and that's just how I thought they were. The Northern Cavalry, for example, works pretty well, but I have my problems with certain Lannister units because they have a uniformity to them, a standard of equipment that I don't think the books really transport. But that is not a problem that Battles of Westeros has alone. Much of the fan art and official art is way too uniform in that aspect. Displaying large armors that are alike and similar for the troops, giving them a feel like they are more a modern day army just clad in metal than they are a medieval army.
Uh-huh.
And for example, the northern infantrymen, they carry big two-handed battle axes, and I don't really feel like this is the northern army I envision when I read Game of Thrones. But that is a thing of personal style and personal favors, I think.
Right.
You can only be so close to the books without unbalancing the game. You need some uniformity in the units and that sort of thing. In the board game, for example, although like the Greyjoys and the Baratheons are given an extra ship to try to signify that they have some naval power at the start of the game. So things like that are in there, but with limits.
Okay.
Yeah, of course, a cavalryman will have basically the same strength with every faction, although we know that Lannister knights are way superior to their counterparts of, say, House Martell, who doesn't possess any knights in the book to speak of, at least in army terms, or the ones of the North. The North has more outriders and skirmishes, but you can't transport that in a game because it would just be a mess of rules then.
Yeah.
I mean, I hadn't even really given much thought to... Obviously, so much of a big part of the appeal of the books is the sort of attention to detail, and you're going to have to streamline and simplify when you're gamifying any of that. That makes sense.
Yeah, it is a real problem when you are designing a game, because a friend of mine and me, we were disappointed with these shortcomings of the games in respect to the books and the style and the theme. And so we tried to make up a board game of our own. And after a while, we realized that our game may be more or less correct to the books, true to the books, but you can't play it. It is no game. It becomes a simulation, and it wouldn't be any fun at all. And so we were even more disappointed this time in our own work, and now continue to play the official games, looking from a different perspective.
Yeah.
It is really hard to design something like this.
Well, shall we move on to number three?
Yeah, of course. Our number three is the video game, the first of two video games to be published by the French publisher Cyanide Games. They recently made a game about the Warhammer universe, I think, with the Blood Bowl thing, which received mixed critics, to say the least. And many people were very skeptical that they would pull off a Game of Thrones game. But they are the guys who got the license, so they did it. And they are producing two games, one strategy game, one role-playing game. And the strategy game has been released about, half a year ago or something?
Yeah.
And it is called the Game of Thrones Genesis, because it covers the last 1,000 or 1,500 years of the history of Westeros, and lets you play through the history of Westeros from the landing of Nymeria to the War of the Five Kings, basically. And that all sounds very fun in theory, and it proves to be a mess in reality, to say the least. And yeah, well, I just have to bring it in. Who did expect French guys to make a good war game, right? But but you have to say, to their credit, what they are trying to do is not making a war game.
Yeah.
I think many people expected a war game, and they don't even try to do that. They had very good ideas. You can see it when you play the game. You see where they wanted to go, but they never quite arrived there. The game has so many problems that could have been avoided had they tested it more vigorously, had they invested more time. But there are really good ideas there. So, I mean, you did play it, right?
I haven't actually played it. My friends have, and who I trust in their opinion, and they weren't really impressed with it overall. I think it was a mistake to come out with the RTS first. I mean, RTS is a difficult market to get into. I know they had some good ideas with it, but the RPG is apparently their flagship game. You think that would be the one that they would bring out first? So
yeah, that one looks a lot better to judge from the videos too. I mean, what they did try in the RTS game is to transport this feeling of deceiving other players to do the shady things, send spies, negotiate settlements, all that stuff. The military part was clearly designed to be a background thing, not as important as the the subterfuge part. And it's basically the idea of transporting a Game of Thrones, the board game, into a real-time strategy game on PC. And this is a very interesting idea. It generates a play feeling you don't see in any other game. That has to be said. It's very innovative.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work on several levels. You start as a lord. The game board is divided into areas, and each area has either a village or a castle. To simplify it a bit, and you gain access over these areas by sending in an envoy who talks to the people and makes an alliance with them. And you can seal alliances by marrying off daughters, and that will produce an heir, and you can send spies to kill envoys and assassins and stuff like that. And in the end, you also can build units that fight with each other and conquer villages and castles. But the idea was to make secret pacts, which you can do with a spy. Then the enemy doesn't see that the village he thinks is his is in reality in a pact with the enemy, and he will only learn if they call the banners. Stuff like that. Really great ideas. You constantly have to check. There is a fog of war over everything, and the ideas were just great, but in reality it doesn't work.
It seems almost like a medieval Total War type of game.
Yeah, but without the battles.
Yeah.
You have the thing from the strategy in real time without battles.
From what I've, you know, again, I haven't played any of these things, so I'm very useful in this discussion. But the impression that I get is that, as you say, a lot of these ideas are interesting, compelling even, but stripped of the sort of visceral excitement that you get from the books, from, you know, in a game's case, it would be battles is where you get that. And in the books, it's both battles and sort of character work, character development. A lot of these ideas then, you know, just sort of come across like a treatise or an essay about how these things would work. It seems like it's difficult to get the players, from the reviews I've read, it's difficult to get people feeling actually involved, instead of that they're just sort of, you know, dealing with a very dry demonstration of how certain aspects of the, you know, the wielding of power would work in this world. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes and no. The thing is that the game could work. For example, if you send an envoy to a village, you can imagine that there is a neutral lord. For example, you play in Riverrun and you send an envoy to what would be Seaguard, and then you have to convince the lord of Seaguard to be your vassal. So that makes a lot of sense, because it transports this feeling of overlords and vassals and feudalism that makes up much of the appeal of Westeros. And it is not just send in your troops and then the country is yours. You have to do something for it. And the loyalty of any given village will decrease over time if you don't do something for it. For example, marry your daughter with them, or send the envoy in again to talk to them, to give them a sense of that you care. And these are really good ideas. They just balanced it wrong all the time. But it could have been a very good mechanism to transport the feeling of a Game of Thrones, especially if they had taken more attention to detail, to give the towns the real names, to put familiar faces on the characters, stuff like that. But they did get the license too late, for example, if I remember correctly. There was a lot of things that went wrong in the production of the game. But it could have transported all these feelings quite good.
I sort of have to wonder then why they did release it. If they had another game with a more popular genre that seems better received, just, you know, obviously it's not out yet. If they had that in the pipeline and they had problems with this one, was it just to recoup the investment? Or?
Yeah, I think it was basically financial reasons, because Cyanide Games is not a very large company, and producing two games simultaneously will have drained the resources at a certain extent. And you can't just scrap a game. They're in a Blizzard Entertainment who would say after 2 years of production, oh, StarCraft Ghost sucks, and then scramble it. I think they simply couldn't afford that. And they also couldn't afford to take half a year longer to make the game good, I guess.
They had two separate groups working independently, so it could be that they just finished it earlier, although, and you're right, they could have worked on it longer, sort of thing. But in some ways, I'm not surprised that from what I've heard, there's problems with the AI, with the mechanics, because they don't have a lot of experience making RTS games. So it's difficult to just jump into RTS games and make a good one, compared to companies that have made 3, 4, 5 different editions of a game. Like Blizzard, for example.
Yeah, could imagine.
Well, chalk it up to experience then, I suppose. And maybe there's better stuff coming down from the pipeline from them.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Well, there is. I'm a lot more excited about the RPG. We specifically, on the podcast of Ice Fire, we just had an interview with Atlas, who's publishing the RPG in North America. And I'm excited about that game.
I'm excited about that one. Perhaps it will do a better job at narrating a story than the RTS did.
Yeah.
That really was the thing that surprised me most about the RTS, because the single-player campaign it had, it sounded so good waging all these wars from Nymeria to the War of Five Kings and experiencing the rich history of Westeros, and then the single-player campaign just sucked so bad. I have never ever played a single-player campaign that was so badly done. I just played it so that I would finish it and see if it improves at some point, but it just got worse and worse. You start the game with Nymeria, and a window pops up with her poorly drawn image, and she tells you, "No, we are here in Dorne, and now we will have to scout. So go out and scout and send your envoy to a village." And then you do it, and then you win. So now we have a foothold in Dorne. And so goes the whole game. And for example, the Battle of the Bells, you have Robert Baratheon, who has a really bad voice actor, and you have to walk around between the clear-put houses of Stony Set, trying to avoid Lannister patrols, not Lannister, Targaryen patrols, and it is so fucking boring because the units move so slowly and it is no suspense at all. It is really, you can't imagine until you have seen it. And then Eddard Stark comes after you have done it and brings some units with him, and it is, oh, Eddard, it is good you've come because now I have units. Yes, let's defeat the Targaryens. And then the mission is over. And you think, what was that? And the whole game is full of aspects like that. The last mission is with Stannis Baratheon defeating the wildlings north of the wall, and it might be correct that the wildlings don't stand a chance against the knights, but it makes for a pretty bad mission if you just stamp over every unit that comes along. And you really have just to click in front of your units, then they walk a bit, then wildlings come, you kill them all, and you move on and until the mission is finished.
It would be nice if it worked that way for certain characters in the books. Things would have gone a lot smoother for them.
Yeah, a whole lot. But you can see you could have done such a lot of things with this, even if they had thought of publishing a scenario editor for it.
Yeah.
After the game was out, I asked one of the developers in the message boards they made up. They had a very good support. You have to give them that.
Mm.
They communicated with the community. And I asked, how about a scenario editor? Then we could make our own brackets good campaign. But they said that they couldn't not release one because the one they used was too complicated and stuff, and they didn't plan on releasing one. I think if they had made their game mod friendly, that could have helped them a real bit. That was one of the biggest PR and marketing mistakes.
I just one quick comment. When you mentioned Nymeria, I just saw Wolfhead talking in my mind. Wrong Nymeria in my head, but.
Yeah, I think we basically covered all the topics of these three games. So don't be disheartened by any of our criticisms, especially Game of Thrones, the board game, and Battles of Westeros are both worth the money if you are into this kind of games. And you can, if you get the Genesis game, if you can see it for $5 or something, you can give it a look.
I think it was on sale for $5 or something lately. So
yeah, so if you can pick it up for something like that, give it a try, because to see the mechanisms and the innovative thing, it can be worth your time, but don't expect too much of it.
I would put that money into the RPG, because specifically they have a really nice art book that comes with it, which is almost like worth the cost of it itself. If you pre-order it, you get like this deluxe art book. So even if you don't end up liking the game, you get the book.
Okay, that's worth considering into. Yeah.
Of the three of them, the video game is probably the one that's least likely to be eaten by my baby. So small parts that she can consume. So I may check it out for that reason.
She does, she'll vomit it back up. So
right
from Stefan's description. But the one thing we didn't cover, unfortunately, was a card game, because we haven't played it. But from what I've heard, it's a good game and it fits the theme of the books. So it's worth.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too.
Well, we may have to rendezvous again when if you guys get that one under your belts.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you very much, fellas. This was a pleasure. I feel like I learned something about an aspect of fandom I don't actually really know anything about. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool.
And now I am off to that baby and preventing her from eating small game pieces or whatever else she's crawling around eating. So
yeah.
But, thanks, Amin. Thanks again for stopping by our humble podcast.
It was great, and thanks to Stefan for joining us on Guys Night Out 4. It was good.
I'm
honored. There's nothing to think about it.
Yeah, I will make sure to link to that on the blog as well. But everyone, for a sort of extra episode of Boiled Leather Audio Hour, sort of an honorary episode, definitely check out one of the most recent episodes of a podcast of Ice and Fire featuring Stefan and Amin and lots of other illustrious personages from fandom. So.
Elio or Elio, depending on how you say it.
Yes, potato, potato.
Yeah, but as you said, the last half an hour goes off the track, so you got to be drunk if you're listening to that part. You got to be drinking along the Arbor Red if you're listening.
Great strategy.
Yeah.
Yeah, very great, very great. We should implement it too.
All right, gentlemen, that was a pleasure. Thank you very much. And everyone who's listening, thank you for listening for a sort of different episode of Blah. I hope it was not blah for you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Until the next time.
All right, take care, fellas.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye.